white lodges. I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver.
As much as I'm in the business of promoting regreening and it's all about trees and that, I've really come to appreciate and to realize over the last few years, it's about sowing joy. And I have these most incredible reactions when I run a workshop. People break into dance, they start clapping, they make up songs. It's really, really fun. And they get excited. And I think you come into a situation where you've got a trodden down people, beaten down, and hear all this scare talk about climate change. I don't want to diminish the seriousness of it, but people are really worried. And the conditions are worsening. Greater severity of storms, greater droughts, stronger winds blowing the roofs off, no fodder, decreasing crop yields. They're really scared. And then you tell them, you know, these insignificant tree stumps here, these little sprouts that you cut and burn every year and you plow under, actually they could make a big difference. Always try to work with the existing structures, whether there's a traditional structure or a farmers development group or a cooperative. Work through the existing structures, much, much easier than trying to create new ones. Some of the hardest people I have in convincing about this method are professionals. And so here's this really cheap method. You can do it with a $2 pocket knife, very rapid. And yet the establishment, in a way, has been spending millions of dollars trying to solve the problem of desertification, trying to regreen these semi-arid areas. And you're trying to tell me that you can do it with a pocket knife and a group of people who are mostly uneducated? And I say, yes, yes you can, and that's all it takes.
You're listening to episode 633 of Unwelcome Guests, putting the mental back in environmental. I'm Robin Upton. And you've just heard aid worker Tony Rinaldo speaking about his experience at reforesting Niger, not by planting new trees, not by the traditional top-down NGO-managed project, but by allowing what's already there to grow back. A very simple technique, something that anybody could do, as he says, given a $2 pocket knife. So why hasn't that been given huge publicity and spread around the world? Is it perhaps because some of the structures and systems in place, charities, NGOs, don't want environmental problems solved in a simple grassroots fashion? They would rather be in charge, would rather do it through a top-down plan. We shall hear the rest of that presentation from Tony Rinaldo in a second hour to conclude the show. Now let's hear Radio EcoShock's Alex Smith interviewing filmmaker Mike Friedman on his new and, we hope, soon forthcoming film.
Filmmaker Mike Friedman says we've hit critical mass towards extinction by overpopulation.
Back in the 1950s, we heard about some experiments done by a man called Cahoon, in which he put rats into a limited space and then gave them unlimited resources. The rat population started to grow. It reached a point where they could no longer function as rats. Their social structure collapsed. The population was in serious trouble.
To make a bomb, you need critical mass. In the nuclear world, critical mass is the amount of radioactive material required in just the right shape to create a self-sustaining chain reaction and maybe a devastating explosion. Millions of people around the world are wondering if we're heading towards that moment. Filmmaker Mike Friedman set out to document the really big picture, the forces that could culminate in disaster for humanity and most living things. Mike, will you have an earlier short documentary up on Vimeo called Between Two Mirrors, Occupy London? Tell us about that.
Well, while I was in production on Critical Mass, I had a friend staying with me from Australia, Sharon Ead, who also helped us with the interviews on the long dock, and we decided to go down and check out the first day of the Occupy protest in London. I have a little GoPro camera that you can mount on your head. And to my amazement, with the camera mounted on my head, I could just walk around filming, and no one seemed to notice, really, that I was wearing a camera. So I went down, I spoke to some of the police, I spoke to some of the protesters, and then with about 40 minutes of footage, I just chopped it up into a little 8-minute thing that I felt was good enough to make available. In terms of why I chose that name and why I feel that that little 8-minute thing is worth watching, I was struck by the complicity of the protesters in their own enclosure. As I say briefly in that short documentary, there's an element of consent in a protest like that, where the ring of police surrounding the protesters isn't big enough or strong enough to really hold them. So there's a kind of consent to accept the authority that's imposed. And a few people have criticized the police in the UK, and similar allegations have been made against other police forces around the world, of undue brutality in putting down ideological protests like the Occupy movement. And to me, I wanted to make a point that the police at that protest were suffering from exactly the consequences of the perfidy that Occupy were protesting against. And in fact, there's a police officer who says quite clearly that, you know, it's his job to keep the protesters in, whether or not he agrees with them. And the Metropolitan Police Force that were keeping them enclosed were suffering massive, stringent cuts across the board, especially to frontline policing and backroom staff. And so, obviously, there was a sympathy there. And it struck me, and I elaborated on it in an open letter to the Occupy movement that I posted on my blog on the website, which was that we're in a time now, socially speaking, that there are no good and bad people anymore. There's simply people who know what's going on and people who've been misinformed. There's a verse in the Tao, which I used to conclude that short documentary, which is, "What is a good man but a bad man's teacher? What is a bad man but a good man's job?" And I find it very striking that in what we call the information age, the dividing line in most social or political conflicts is drawn by access to the right information. And so it seemed to me that the protesters were one mirror of our culture and the police were another. The police would just as easily be facing outwards protecting them if the rules changed ever so slightly, because the police force is a tool, not a weapon. Its deadliness or its passivity is dictated by the hand that wields it. And so I felt that I was between two mirrors, as in both of them essentially neutral, simply reflecting what they were being told. On the one hand, people being told that their futures were going to be bleaker, that we were giving money to the banks that could be better used for social programs, that social programs had to be cut because of quote-unquote necessity. And on the other hand, a mirror showing us that the establishment doesn't respond well to ideological criticism. Time again, you see that plenty of space is given to protests against single issues or protests in favor of a whole wealth of things, but when there really is a resistance and a crackdown from the establishment, it tends to be something like the Occupy movement, which has at its core not an activity, but an ideal. And this always seems very threatening. So that was why I called it Between Two Mirrors. And that was the thinking that led me to put it up on the web for free, in the hope that people would watch it and share it.
Well, we should backtrack then, because you were already on your adventure to grab the big picture, the whole ball of wax. What started you out on that?
Being a filmmaker, I watch a lot of films. You know, if you want to be a writer, you have to read. If you want to make films, you have to watch them. And I'm a big fan of documentary, especially environmental documentary. And I noticed a trend in environmental films that were otherwise well-researched and perfectly competently constructed, that they tended to stop short or skirt around the issue of population. They would discuss the depletion of a resource or the destruction of a natural environment. And if they did mention the role of people in that depletion or destruction, it was usually couched as a consumption issue, as if consumption was the only issue. And it seemed to me that that was either an oversight or disingenuous, or, to give them the credit that they rightly deserve, simply that it's too big of a subject to be tackled as an aside in a documentary focusing on something else. And so my motive for making Critical Mass was that I believe very strongly that the number of humans alive on the planet and the way that number changes the way we think and feel and behave has an intimate relationship with the other environmental crises we see around us, and also itself an intimate relationship with the manner in which and the amount that we consume. And so wanting to frame that properly in a film, I set out to begin my research. But I didn't want to make a Malthusian dirge telling everyone that people were bad for the planet and that all consumption is terrible and that, you know, there should be less people. That's not what I believe, and it's not what I was hoping to achieve. My goal was to basically recount the human story in a hope that it would point to a deeper understanding of where we stood now.
Well, of course, we got to talk about John Calhoun's rat experiment, which is in your movie trailer for Critical Mass. Talk to us about that. What was he trying to do? Why did he do it? And what does it tell us?
Well, that's exactly the right point to ask that question, Alex, so I thank you. Basically, I came across Calhoun's experiments in my preliminary reading. And once I knew about those experiments, I had my narrative. I had my story that I could tell. And then from that story, on that spine, if you like, I could hang the parallels to the human situation, which is the way that we made the film. Calhoun himself was a, depending on which job title you use, the most common is a research psychologist at the National Institute of Mental Health, which itself is very interesting because Calhoun only ever worked with rodents. And so it was very telling that in his early career, he was transferred from, I believe it was Walter Reed, to the National Institute of Mental Health, which deals explicitly with mental health for people. So there was always implied within his work and made explicit by him several times a parallel to human behavior, human society. The way that Calhoun conducted his experiments was very simple. He would construct an enclosure that contained all the necessary food, water, and nesting material for survival. He would place breeding pairs, so male and female rodents, into those enclosures, and he would simply allow them to roam around this Garden of Eden. And slowly they would begin to reproduce, and that reproduction would accelerate. And as this trend continued, he charted the progress of the population's growth and the manner in which the rat's behavior changed over time, both of which bear striking parallels to human behavior and human society as it's developed. It's also worth noting that in terms of knowing what rats were like, Calhoun literally wrote the book on the Norway rat. He wrote a book called The Ecology of the Norway Rat. So this was a man who was intimately acquainted with the behavior of this species in the wild. And so he was uniquely placed to discuss and investigate the way that that species' behavior changed when transplanted from its natural setting to an enclosure that he himself referred to as Rat City. He believed that he was replicating conditions for the rats that we see in human urban environments. And so his work was always meant to be understood as a way, a lens of viewing ourselves and our urban environments and the way in which we interact with one another and how that has changed, how it may change, and how we can preserve those very special and unique bonds that we consider valuable in human society.
But, Mike, is the rat experiment really a good model to predict what will happen to humans on an expanding, expanding on a finite planet? Aren't we more intelligent?
Well, I'll leave the question as to whether we're more intelligent than rats to one side for a moment. I want to make something absolutely clear, which is that I'm not suggesting, and nor did Calhoun suggest, that what the rats did, so shall we do. That is not what he meant. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that all mammals, like rodents and humans, have behavior patterns, some of which are genetic, some of which are learned, some of which are simple, some of which are complex. And those behavior patterns change depending on the social conditions in which we live. Now, it's not to say that what a rat does in an enclosure, a human will do in a city. It is, however, worth considering that there are structural similarities. So rats have a type of society. Humans have a type of society. Rats have certain behaviors. Humans have certain behaviors. And within a dense, stressful, crowded, impersonal milieu, the rats suffered. And I don't necessarily believe it needs to be argued that humans also suffer in dense, stressed, crowded, impersonal milieu. So the parallel is not meant to be direct. It is meant to be, in essence, as I said before, a lens or a metaphor for what we're going through and what we may continue to go through. As for humans being more intelligent, towards the end of the film, I offer an observation, which is that, and I believe this is verbatim because I had to memorize it to record it in the voiceover booth, humans might not be rats, but that doesn't mean we can't learn from what happened to them. It means we have to do better.
You have Bill Reese, the Global Footprint guy, and zoologist Desmond Morris, the author of The Naked Ape, talking about population instead of sustainability, or are they really the same subject?
I don't think it needs to be argued that the number of people alive on the planet is uniquely linked to whether or not the society in which those people live is sustainable. I think the idea that humans exist somehow separate from an impact on nature and the bounds of the laws of physics and inertia and sustainability, I don't need to speak to that more than it has been so far. I avoid using the word sustainability in my day-to-day life because I believe it's wildly overused. I was browsing the internet the other day and I saw a website for a company that was offering sustainable design. So I have no idea what the hell they were selling. And I think it's a wildly overused and washed out term. I think, as Albert Bartlett in his excellent, if chilling, lecture that is viewable for free on YouTube said about population growth, take a 0.1% increase in human population and extrapolate it indefinitely, and you'll see that it does eventually reach a point where it's unsustainable. Unsustainable in the sense that it cannot be sustained further. So whatever it is, whether it's 5 trillion people eating beans or it's 50 people eating tremendous amounts, you know, consumption and population are, as Bob Engelman from the World Watch Institute says, two sides of the same rectangle. You need both of them to calculate the contents, the volume, the area of that rectangle. Bill Reese and Desmond Morris both are intimately familiar with what we've been through in terms of population growth, and they're also very well-versed in what the future looks like. Both of them are very conscious about environmental matters. In an aside during his interview, Desmond told me that he was present at the original meeting of what eventually became the World Wildlife Fund. And he angered the original founder because he suggested that if they really wanted to conserve the animal species of the planet, that they should put their panda motif on a series of condoms and give them out for free. And that made the guy angry, and then apparently Desmond bumped into him 25 years later, and the guy said, actually, you were right. Now, to be clear, I don't advocate anything remotely control-based in terms of the population picture going forward. I'm not in favor of coercion. I'm not largely, to be honest, in favor of most centralized, dominator, top-down, dictatorial methods of governing societies or groups. And I don't think that application of more exaggerated methods in that vein are going to solve the problems that have largely been created by exactly those methods to begin with. I think that it's evident the population is intimately connected to sustainability. I don't think that a human population that grows indefinitely would be sustainable. I also don't necessarily think that we have a population that will grow indefinitely. But the question is, let's say we level off at 10 or 11 billion. What kind of lifestyle will be sustainable then? And then what about if the numbers begin to decline? What type of society would be sustainable then? One of the great challenges going forward now, as we see playing out the economic crises in Europe and the ongoing stagnation in Japan and in the United States, is that we have a structural political and economic framework to our societies that demands growth, that requires it, because all of our models, all of our methods are predicated on the idea that there's going to be more throughput, more people, more goods, and more consumption year on year. And when that is not present, our economics fails to explain what is happening. And this is exactly what we're seeing around the world right now in those countries that are either experiencing stagnant economic growth or leveled off or decreasing population. So the question is not only, can we increase indefinitely? I don't think we can, and I also don't think we will. And the question isn't, is population at a high level sustainable? A deeper question is, how can we reorganize and redesign our social, political, and economic systems to accurately meet and reflect and fulfill the real needs of human beings? It's too easy to point at a spreadsheet and talk about what growth is and what it does. It's much harder to see human beings as holistic, living creatures that have emotional and psychological needs as well as their physical needs. And this, I think, is one of the great worries in not only the current political and economic sectors, but also in the environmental movement. The environmental movement has traditionally emphasized the kind of the accounting tools of sustainability. How much water use, how much pollution, how much food do we need? But as Calhoun himself said, we need to put the mental back in environmental. You know, humans have deeper needs and a more meaningful purpose in life than merely finding enough rice to eat for the day and having enough water. And so we shouldn't simply think about the bare bones of supplying survival. We need to think about what it will mean to ensure that every person born on this beautiful planet of ours has a full, meaningful life. And that's the real challenge. Whether population is going up, whether it's stabilizing, or whether it's declining, is being willing to reassess and reorganize all of our assumptions, all of our algorithms and spreadsheets, all of our models for planning and molding society based purely on the quality of the life experience for every person alive.
You know, I love what you've just said, and I think my listeners are going to really appreciate it. I have to ask you, in your promo clips, I didn't see anything about that other big threat, global climate disruption. Did you cover that as well?
We don't discuss climate change in the film for several reasons. First of all, because it's such a tremendous topic that we've already covered in so many films by so many different filmmakers that it was really difficult to find something to say. And this led me to the second point, which is that in thinking about how to talk about the interplay between people and the climate, unfortunately, the majority of that discourse is predicated on exactly the type of accounting that I was discussing just now, in the sense that they have calculated how much CO2 a human releases versus any other animal. They've calculated the savings to global CO2 emissions if people have only two children as opposed to three. They've also calculated that contraception is, in a dollar way, better value for money than renewable energy. But all of these things speak to exactly the system of physical material accounting that, as I just mentioned, I don't fully believe accurately represents what humans need or want in life. And the third reason is that I do feel, and this is a personal thing, I do feel that the environmental movement in the past 15 years has become almost wholesale the climate change movement. And I think that that's a real shame, because I think that I don't know old school because I'm not that old, so I don't know necessarily that it was this way in the past, but the way that environmentalism occurs to me, which is to protect what you see around you from the things that threaten it, is a much more local, community-based approach to stewardship. And we seem now to have global environmental NGOs with corporate mission statements and sponsors, and they have board meetings and the rest of it, and they have expense accounts, and they travel, and they go to symposiums, and they talk to politicians. But on the ground, there's so much to be done to preserve our forests, to preserve our water, to preserve our land, to make sure that the air that we breathe is clean, to make sure that what falls out of the sky isn't laced with something that got put up miles away. There's so much to be done that in itself, if it was addressed at the local community level, would have a knock-on effect at the global level, including carbon emissions. that I didn't feel that this film could bring in the climate change thread in a way that would, A, be new, B, be relevant to the thrust of what we were saying in the film, and C, be productive to the aim that I had for the movie, which is to invite further discussion of the role of human numbers and human consumption on our impact on the planet and on our psychology, and also to invite further study on how we can change and help each other and be more compassionate.
So what do you need now, Mike Friedman, to get this movie out there?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Alex. We've completed the film. We've previewed it at a couple of festivals. The reception has been uniformly positive, which is very encouraging. We've had favorable comments from several very well-placed individuals. And we've had offers of distribution as well for DVD and theatrical in Italy, for DVD in the UK. And we have an offer of a digital partnership here in the U.S., and I'm also currently on my way to Los Angeles to take a couple more meetings with distributors there. Now, the stumbling block we have is that in the film we use some archive footage, so footage that we sourced from the 1960s, the 1950s, the 1980s, and the companies that supply this footage don't offer it as a pro bono charity service for indie filmmakers, unfortunately.
And I trimmed a bit off the end of that interview, so suffice it to say that if you go to criticalmassfilm.com, you can donate money to try to buy the licenses for the footage that's in the film so they can distribute it. It's an all-too-familiar pattern. The existing social hierarchies, the existing institutions erecting barriers to try to prevent change from taking place. In particular, those who wield money are insistent that the real world, considerations about who's eaten recently or which ecosystems we can keep alive, that these considerations must never become more important in people's minds than their own priorities of interest, license payments, and so forth. Now, for another note of caution about those who would use a spreadsheet to analyze the population situation, we're going to hear the soundtrack of a presentation given to Ted Salor London in May 2012, this is called the Global Food Waste Scandal.
Here's Triscrum Stewart.
The job of uncovering the global food waste scandal started for me when I was 15 years old. I bought some pigs, I was living in Sussex, and I started to feed them in the most traditional and environmentally friendly way. I went to my school kitchen and I said, "Give me the scraps that my school friends have turned their noses up at." I went to the local baker and took their stale bread. I went to the local greengrocer, and I went to a farmer who was throwing away potatoes because they were the wrong shape or size for supermarkets. This was great. My pigs turned that food waste into delicious pork. I sold that pork to my school friend's parents, and I made a good pocket money addition to my teenage allowance. But I noticed that most of the food that I was giving my pigs was in fact fit for human consumption, and that I was only scratching the surface. And that right the way up the food supply chain, in supermarkets, greengrocers, bakers, in our homes, in factories on farms, we were hemorrhaging out food. Supermarkets didn't even want to talk to me about how much food they were wasting. I'd been round the back, I'd seen bins full of food being locked and then trucked off to landfill sites, and I thought, surely there is something more sensible to do with food than waste it. One morning, when I was feeding my pigs, I noticed a particularly tasty-looking sun-dried tomato loaf that used to crop up from time to time. I grabbed hold of it, sat down, and ate my breakfast with my pigs. That was the first act of what I later learned to call freeganism, really an exhibition of the injustice of food waste and the provision of the solution to food waste, which is simply to sit down and eat food rather than throwing it away. That became, as it were, a way of confronting large businesses in the business of wasting food and exposing, most importantly, to the public that when we're talking about food being thrown away, we're not talking about rotten stuff, we're not talking about stuff that's beyond the pale, we're talking about good fresh food that is being wasted on a colossal scale. Eventually, I set about writing my book, really to demonstrate the extent of this problem on a global scale. What this shows is a nation-by-nation breakdown of the likely level of food waste in each country in the world. Unfortunately, empirical data, good hard stats, don't exist. And therefore, to prove my point, I first of all had to find some proxy way of uncovering how much food was being wasted. So I took the food supply of every single country, and I compared it to what was actually likely to be being consumed in each country. That's based on diet intake surveys, it's based on levels of obesity, it's based on a range of factors that gives you an approximate guess as to how much food is actually going into people's mouths. That black line in the middle of that table is the likely level of consumption with an allowance for certain levels of inevitable waste. There will always be waste. I'm not that unrealistic that I think we can live in a waste-free world. But that black line shows what a food supply should be in a country if they allow for a good, stable, secure, nutritional diet for every person in that country. Any dot above that line, and you'll quickly notice that that includes most countries in the world, represents unnecessary surplus and is likely to reflect levels of waste in each country. As a country gets richer, it invests more and more in getting more and more surplus into its shops and restaurants. And as you can see, most European and North American countries fall between 150 and 200% of the nutritional requirements of their population. So a country like America has twice as much food on its shop shelves and in its restaurants than is actually required to feed the American people. But the thing that really struck me when I plotted all this data, and it was a lot of numbers, was that you can see how it levels off. Countries rapidly shoot towards that 150 mark, and then they level off. And they don't really go on rising as you might expect. So I decided to unpack that data a little bit further to see if that was true or false. And that's what I came up with. If you include not just the food that ends up in shops and restaurants, but also the food that people feed to livestock, the maize, the soy, the wheat, that humans could eat, but choose to fatten livestock instead to produce increasing amounts of meat and dairy products, what you find is that most rich countries have between 3 and 4 times the amount of food that their population needs to feed itself. A country like America has 4 times the amount of food that it needs. When people talk about the need to increase global food production to feed those 9 billion people that are expected on the planet by 2050, I always think of these graphs. The fact is we have an enormous buffer in rich countries between ourselves and hunger. We've never had such gargantuan surpluses before. In many ways, this is a great success story of human civilization, of the agricultural surpluses that we set out to achieve 12,000 years ago. It is a success story. It has been a success story. But what we have to recognize now is that we are reaching the ecological limits that our planet can bear. And when we chop down forests, as we are every day, to grow more and more food, when we extract water from depleting water reserves, when we emit fossil fuel emissions in the quest to grow more and more food, and then we will throw away so much of it, we have to think about what we can start saving. And yesterday, I went to one of the local supermarkets that I often visit to inspect, if you like, what they're throwing away. I found quite a few packets of biscuits amongst all the fruit and vegetables and everything else that was in there. And I thought, well, this could serve as a symbol for today. So I want you to imagine that these 9 biscuits that I found in the bin represent the global food supply. Okay? We start out with 9. That's what's in fields around the world every single year. The first biscuit we're going to lose before we even leave the farm. That's a problem primarily associated with developing world agriculture, where there is a lack of infrastructure, refrigeration, pasteurization, grain stores, even basic fruit crates, which means that food goes to waste before it even leaves the fields. The next 3 biscuits are the foods that we decide to feed to livestock, the maize, the wheat, and the soya. Unfortunately, our beasts are inefficient animals, and they turn 2/3 of that into feces and heat. So we've lost those 2, and we've only kept this 1 in meat and dairy products. 2 more we're going to throw away directly into bins. This is what most of us think of when we think of food waste, what ends up in the garbage, what ends up in supermarket bins, what ends up in restaurant bins. We've lost another 2, and we've left ourselves with just 4 biscuits to feed on. That is not a superlatively efficient use of global resources, especially when you think of the billion hungry people that exist already in the world. Having gone to the data, I then needed to demonstrate where that food ends up. Where does it end up? We're used to seeing the stuff on our plates, but what about all the stuff that goes missing in between? Supermarkets are an easy place to start. This is the result of my hobby, which is unofficial bin inspections. Strange you might think, but if we could rely on corporations to tell us what they were doing in the back of their stores, we wouldn't need to go sneaking around the back, opening up bins and having a look at what's inside. But this is what you can see, more or less, on every street corner in Britain, in Europe, in North America. It represents a colossal waste of food. But what I discovered whilst I was writing my book was that this very evident abundance of waste was actually the tip of the iceberg. When you start going up the supply chain, you find where the real food waste is happening on a gargantuan scale. Can I have a show of hands? If you have a loaf of sliced bread in your house, who lives in a household where that crust, that slice at the first and last end of each loaf, who lives in a household where it does get eaten? Okay, most people. Not everyone, but most people. And this is, I'm glad to say, what I see across the world. And yet, has anyone seen a supermarket or sandwich shop anywhere in the world that serves sandwiches with crusts on it? I certainly haven't. So I kept on thinking, where do those crusts go? This is the answer, unfortunately. 13,000 slices of fresh bread coming out of this one single factory every single day. Day fresh bread. In the same year that I visited this factory, I went to Pakistan, where people in 2008 were going hungry as a result of a squeeze on global food supplies. We contribute to that squeeze by depositing food in bins here in Britain and elsewhere in the world. We take food off the market shelves that hungry people depend on. Go one step up and you get to farmers who throw away sometimes a third or even more of their harvest because of cosmetic standards. This farmer, for example, has invested £16,000 in growing spinach, not one leaf of which he harvested because there was a little bit of grass growing in amongst it. Potatoes that are cosmetically imperfect, all going for pigs. Parsnips that are too small for supermarket specifications. Tomatoes in Tenerife. Oranges in Florida. Bananas in Ecuador, where I visited last year. All being discarded. This is one day's waste from one banana plantation in Ecuador. All being discarded, perfectly edible, because they're the wrong shape or size. If we do that to fruit and vegetables, you bet we can do it to animals too. Liver, lungs, heads, tails, kidneys, testicles, all of these things which are traditional, delicious and nutritious parts of our gastronomy go to waste. Offal consumption has halved in Britain and America in the last 30 years. As a result, this stuff gets fed to dogs at best, or is incinerated. This man in Kashgar, Xinjiang province in western China, is serving up his national dish. It's called sheep's organs. It's delicious, it's nutritious, and as I learned when I went to Kashgar, it symbolizes their taboo against food waste. I was sitting at a roadside cafe, a chef came to talk to me, I finished my bowl, and halfway through the conversation, he stopped talking and he started frowning into my bowl. I thought, my goodness, what taboo have I broken? How have I insulted my host? He pointed at three grains of rice at the bottom of my bowl, and he said, clean. I thought, my God, you know, I go around the world telling people to stop wasting food. This guy has thrashed me at my own game. But it gave me faith. It gave me faith that we, the people, do have the power to stop this tragic waste of resources. If we regard it as socially unacceptable to waste food on a colossal scale, if we make a noise about it, tell corporations about it, tell governments we want to see an end to food waste, we do have the power to bring about that change. Fish, 40 to 60% of European fish are discarded at sea. They don't even get landed. In our homes, we've lost touch with food. This is an experiment I did on three lettuces. Who keeps lettuces in their fridge? Most people. The one on the left was kept in a fridge for 10 days. The one in the middle on my kitchen table, not much difference. The one on the right, I treated like cut flowers. It's a living organism. Cut the slice off, stuck it in a vase of water. It was all right for another 2 weeks after this. Some food waste, as I said at the beginning, will inevitably arise. So the question is, what is the best thing to do with it? I answered that question when I was 15. In fact, humans answered that question 6,000 years ago. We domesticated pigs to turn food waste back into food. And yet, in Europe, that practice has become illegal since 2001 as a result of the foot and mouth outbreak. It's unscientific, it's unnecessary. If you cook food, for pigs, just as if you cook food for humans, it is rendered safe. It's also a massive saving of resources. At the moment, Europe depends on importing millions of tons of soy from South America, where its production contributes to global warming, to deforestation, to biodiversity loss, to feed livestock here in Europe. At the same time, we throw away millions of tons of food waste, which we could and should be feeding them. If we did that and fed it to pigs, we would save that amount of carbon. If we feed our food waste, which is the current sort of government favorite way of getting rid of food waste, to anaerobic digestion, which turns food waste into gas to produce electricity, you save a paltry 448 kilograms of carbon dioxide per ton of food waste. It's much better to feed it to pigs. We knew that during the war. A silver lining. It has kicked off globally the quest to tackle food waste. Feeding the 5,000 is an event I first organized in 2009. We fed 5,000 people, all on food that otherwise would have been wasted. Since then, it's happened again in London, it's happening internationally and across the country. It's a way of organizations coming together to celebrate food, to say the best thing to do with food is to eat and enjoy it and to stop wasting it. For the sake of the planet we live on, for the sake of our children, for the sake of all the other organisms that share our planet with us, we are a terrestrial animal and we depend on our land for food. At the moment, we are trashing our land to grow food that no one eats. Stop wasting food.
And Tristram Stewart has a website, feeding5k.org, which informs me that 2 weeks ago, they had another event with 5,000 people fed with food that would otherwise have been wasted. From a capitalist perspective, this is a waste of time and effort. From a human perspective, I find it very encouraging, people stepping out of the capitalist selfish model. Now we're going to hear a section of an interview. Again, I had to truncate it slightly to fit it in. This is from episode 41 of The Extra Environmentalist, interview with a familiar guest on the show, Robert Wright, about his film, Surviving Progress.
In starting to talk about some of the ideas that are in the film Surviving Progress, one of the first questions that we had for you was, let's say there's another intelligent species and they're coming down to the human race and they're starting to talk to us about our history to try to figure out what's been going on. And so this intelligent species asks you to deliver a short summary of the human race. What would you say to them?
I would say to them that we humans are very clever, but seldom wise.
What do you mean by that? Why are they not wise?
Well, because we don't seem to learn from our mistakes. I mean, just the other day, I was reading about the part of Japan where this terrible tsunami happened, you know, wiping out the Fukushima reactor and so forth. And all around those parts of Japan are stone markers, some of them 10 feet high, which were set up centuries ago. I think the oldest one is 600 years old. And it says, remember the great catastrophe. Do not build below this level. You know, this was set up by the Japanese emperors in the past, warning people not to go lower because sooner or later another tsunami would come. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody paid any attention. We always think we're exempt from the rules of history. We always think we're going to be lucky. That's why we're not wise.
I've listened to your Massey lectures, and that's a theme that comes back again and again, is the fact that civilization seems to forget the lessons of the past over and over and over and over. And, you know, even in our regular day lives, we forget, you know, what happened to our parents' generation. Why is this forgetfulness so a part of being human?
Part of it is cultural, that especially since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and the great speeding up of technology, since that, we in the West have become a culture focused on the future. You know, we are not looking back nearly as much as we're looking ahead. So we're rather like a ship sailing without a rudder, with everyone looking forwards and not backwards. So that's one thing. But also, I think it's deeper than that. I think it is rooted in our evolutionary past, that, you know, we developed over millions of years as hunters, and we're extremely good at mobilizing ourselves for short-term effort and solving immediate problems, or say escaping from a lion, you know, flight or fight kicks in right away. We're good at all that. But we're not good at the long-term planning. And, you know, and proof of that is what I call progress traps. The first of them being when our hunter ancestors in most parts of the world ruined hunting as a way of life by overkill.
And so you mentioned the idea of progress traps, and that's definitely something that comes to play quite a few times in the film Surviving Progress and in your Massey lectures. And I'm wondering, what are some good examples of progress traps? You gave the one about the hunters. Do you have any others?
Oh, well, there are many. A simple one that we can all relate to is weaponry. You know, when you go from a stone arrow to a steel one, or you go from a bow and arrow to a rifle, you've made technological progress that enables you to both kill animals and other people much better. But when you get to the point that you've invented atomic weapons and germ weapons, then you've fallen into a progress trap, because you've invented something that could wipe everyone out. Quite clearly, as weaponry getting better and better and better is a good idea only up to a certain point. That is what's true of most of these things. Another much older example, after hunters had pretty much hunted out the big game in most parts of the world, the survivors of that catastrophe, that food crisis, gradually developed farming. And after a few more thousand years, you get the early civilizations developing. And one of the first in the world is the Sumerians in what is now southern Iraq. And if you look at the pictures from that area, you probably remember them from the recent war there, the place is a desert. It's brown, it's dry, it's dusty, and it's salty. And there are pictures of these ancient temples and palaces and towns just standing in this dusty, salty desert. And that is the result of a progress trap. When those cities were thriving, the place was green and it was extensively irrigated. And the Sumerians effectively invented irrigation in that area, and it worked very well for them for a while. But after about 1,000 years, the evaporation of the water had concentrated salt in the ground, and they found that their yields were falling. They had to change to salt-resistant crops, and when that no longer worked, the civilization came crashing down. So the very thing that was the secret of its success was its undoing in the end. That is a classic progress trap.
You said in one of your talks that each time history repeats itself, the price goes up. And that's a very interesting concept, because as civilizations reemerge after a destruction of an old one, they come back again, they have to put more resources into making that culture the same or better than they were. Could you delve a little bit deeper into the, how that works?
I agree with what you just said. And of course, the other thing is that as the overall experiment of civilization gets more complex and there are more people wielding more powerful technologies, then the risks from those technologies become greater. Actually, that expression, every time history repeats itself, the price goes up, was a graffiti that I think that I saw somewhere. But it struck me as being right on the money, because essentially it's saying, you know, each time we increase our numbers and we have more powerful technologies, we are taking on greater risks. And there is also less room for recovery, less unspoiled land, less places to go after each failure, because the overall scale of these experiments gets bigger all the time.
And you mentioned our technology, and earlier we were talking about how we started out as hunter-gatherers, and now we live in these complex cities with complex energy and material flows, where I can walk down the street here in Vancouver, and just right at the corner, I can go and buy something that was made half the world away. And in some ways, that's really amazing. Should we be commending ourselves as a species for what we've been able to accomplish?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have accomplished a lot of really impressive things. And my purpose in writing A Short History of Progress was not to sort of say civilization's a bad thing, let's give up on it. And my purpose was to say it's a very precious thing and it's a very fragile thing. So let's be careful. We're reaching a very critical stage. Let's try and see far ahead and follow the precautionary principle and try to put this on a long-term stable basis so that we can go on enjoying this way of life. That doesn't mean that we should continue having sort of senseless levels of consumption in the rich countries and terrible levels of poverty in the poorer ones. You know, I'm not saying we should continue going as we are. We need to correct things like that. We need to correct overconsumption. We probably need to do something about overpopulation. In fact, we almost certainly do, but that's a very tricky one, and that would take a lot of sensitivity and intelligent planning to achieve. But in the long run, it probably must be achieved in order to have a number of people on this planet who can all live well, all live a civilized life, assuming they want to, and do so without exhausting the natural resources and poisoning the atmosphere and the oceans.
But it does seem that in every civilization that has emerged on this planet, that a concentration of wealth at the top leads to the preservation of the status quo. So the change becomes even harder. You know, even as we see this huge tsunami bearing down on our current civilization, we're powerless to stop it because the status quo is just so ingrained in what we, in our everyday lives.
Well, I think that we are, in effect, victims of our own human nature. And we are also victims of the social structure and the sort of the momentum that a particular culture and social system has. And it's sometimes been called the runaway train problem. You know, it is extremely hard to stop a huge, complex social organism in its tracks and turn it around. In fact, it's impossible. It can only be done gradually. But what makes it extra difficult is that the people who still benefit from the system, the elites, as you mentioned, the powerful and wealthy people at the top of the social pyramid, those people are very resistant to change because they fear losing their power, losing their money, and they fear revolution. And so they tend to dig in and say, look, there's nothing wrong with the system. In fact, the only thing we need to do is to keep on doing what we've always done, but do it better. And you see this pattern. I think you can see it nowadays, particularly the right wing. You can see it in the political program, particularly of the Republican Party in the United States and of the Conservative Party here in Canada. But you also see it in these ancient civilizations. You know, if you go to the greatest city ever built by the ancient Maya, the city of Tikal in Guatemala. That's a city that was lived in for a long time. If memory serves, it was occupied for 1,500 or 2,000 years, but almost all the really big, impressive pyramids that are there now were built in the last 100 years. So in this city that lasted for millennia, there was this great surge at the end, and along with these great pyramids, you can see the elite trying to bolster its power. You get far more images of the kings. You get a lot more sort of militarism showing up in the sculptures. And you also get the royalty using these pyramids, which had been public temples, using them as private tombs, which was a new thing for the Maya. So you can see that entrenchment. You know, they're saying, no, there's nothing wrong. You know, okay, the peasants are starving, but that just means they need to work harder.
So every time these concentrations of power happen in civilization, it seems that we just get stuck in another progress trap or another kind of culture trap. Is there a way to have a civilization that doesn't form one of these concentrations of wealth at the top or concentrations of power at the top and allow the flexibility that seems to be so needed in a civilization? Is that even a possible model?
Well, it's a very desirable model, and it is really the model that we have to work on now if we're going to keep this experiment of civilization going. This is where we have to go. There have been social experiments around the world where this has worked, at least for a time, and also, of course, in small-scale societies, such as the hunter-gatherer societies that either still exist or existed until very recently, you can see a much more egalitarian social structure. You also see people actually having to work less to make a living in most of these cultures. The people in the Kalahari work about half the length of time per week that people in agricultural or industrial societies do, and they have a broad range of foods. Because they're hunter-gatherers, it's very difficult. They're always moving around. So it's very difficult for an elite to concentrate power and property in one place. And once you move into agricultural and especially industrial societies, of course, it becomes much more difficult. But we've seen many attempts to reform this process. I mean, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Mexican Revolution, all of these revolutions, and the Communist Revolution in China in the 1940s, all of these revolutions were attempts to redistribute wealth and power. In the short run, some of them succeeded, and sometimes they succeeded in creating a new and more flexible and more resilient social structure. But in the long run, there has been a tendency for the power to find its way into fewer and fewer hands. Although I think that is much more true in the United States than it is in France. Both countries who had revolutions at about the same time, both extremely bloody and pervasive revolutions, not just sort of minor coups, but, you know, revolutions that convulsed those whole countries. And yet France has a social democracy in which the idea of redistributing the fruits of capitalism through taxation is not considered something abhorrent as it is to most of the rich and powerful in the United States.
And I'm wondering what it is about human nature that drives for this power for reaching this pinnacle. You know, the Tower of Babel comes to mind, all of our technological progress. It's like we're reaching for something and we haven't been able to attain it. Why do you think power is such a drive of human nature?
Well, I think the drive to power very often originates in fear, in the uncertainties of existence, by exercising some control over nature. By, say, saving water through a dry season to keep for a wet season, we feel that we are using power to make ourselves safer. And that same psychology seems to apply to elites forming nations and particularly empires. You look at most empires, very many of them expand extremely quickly after that particular social group, which may have been in the beginning just a small tribe or city-state, is threatened by outsiders. And there's a crisis, there's a battle with their neighbors in the next valley. And they win, and then they just keep going because that seems to them to be a good idea. They appropriate the land and the wealth of the people they've conquered, and then that, of course, strengthens them. And then, you know, you can see this is what happened with the Romans, what happens with the Aztecs. Suddenly these people are taking over large parts of the world. And I think they believed it makes them safer. Of course, it also makes them more prosperous in the short term. But in the long run, empires don't work. In the long run, the law of diminishing returns cuts in, the costs of maintaining the system and holding down your disgruntled people that you're exploiting eventually become greater than the wealth that you can accumulate. And we're, you know, we've seen that with the Spanish Empire, the British Empire. We're now seeing it with the American Empire.
Well, it seems to me that there's this innate want or desire in humanity to want to follow. Do you find that? Do you see that in studying civilizations? Do humans just basically want to follow somebody greater? Or have they want to put the issues of the day into somebody else to manage so they don't have to think about those things themselves?
Well, I think that is definitely one of our flaws as a species, that we would much rather think that somebody else has the answers, and most of us would sort of delegate our own autonomy to have someone else clean up the mess or solve the problems or fight the enemies, whatever it happens to be. And you see that particularly, of course, in the bigger social systems. Even in democracies, we delegate our power, and in a way that very often leads to the effective loss of powers, as we've seen in Canada, where, you know, a minority can dominate the majority, and because of our peculiar electoral system, can get away with it. So there's a sort of dog-like follow the leader thing. There's also a religious impulse, I think, for a savior. I mean, in many of the earlier civilizations, the leader, the guy at the top, the king, the emperor, was also a god or a demigod. I mean, the Romans actually deified their emperors, and so did many other societies. And this gives the people a belief that the ruler is in touch with heaven and therefore with the forces of nature, and that this is going to guarantee them reliable rains, good crops, all of those things. Of course, it's all nonsense, but that religious impulse is something within us. We do not act as purely rational beings. We consider ourselves an intelligent species, but I suggest in the book that we're really only half evolved towards intelligence. We're actually in this kind of danger zone where we have these very primitive and archaic impulses to violence and fear and anger and worship, and are really quite a long way from being the rational creatures that we like to imagine we are.
You mentioned the Mayan city of Tikal, and I'm wondering what it would have felt like to the people who lived there. How many people lived in the city?
It's hard to get an exact figure, but I believe it would be something like 100,000 in the urban core and 500,000 in the city-state. That was the last time I looked, but of course, archaeological research is often changing these figures.
Right.
But doesn't sound big by modern standards, but that is actually quite a lot for an ancient city-state.
And what do you think it was like for all of those people as Mayan civilization started falling apart? It did happen over several centuries, but do you think there was a certain point where everyone just was like, hey, we're collapsing as a civilization? Like a priest got on top of one of the temples and said, you know, we're falling apart? Or what was it like? What did they do?
Well, we can only infer what happened by the archaeological remains, because although they were a literate civilization who left inscriptions, they didn't leave the bad news. You know, the inscriptions all say that everything's fine and the king is talking to the gods and he's the greatest. You know, that's essentially what inscriptions say in almost any ancient civilization, and the Maya are no different. But what we can see is that the statues of some of these very same kings appear to have had fires lit around the base, and they've been thrown face down, or even the faces have been hacked off.